this side of the sports political horizon, including the concussion thing, more so than what they do in terms of this particular problem.
This problem
is going to be resolved in the community with efforts like the first guest talked about. It's going to be resolved in the community when you bring together the, all of the various stakeholders in that situation and get them around the table. The NFL is not going to solve the problem of police-community relations. They can contribute, but the biggest thing to come out of this will be a model for them to work with players in terms of handling other issues as the league becomes blacker.
I want to thank you both for being with us, Dr. Harry Edwards, Professor Emeritus of Sociology, University of California, Berkeley, a consultant with the 49ers, and also Mel Reeves with the Take a Knee Nation in Minneapolis. We're going to do part two and post online at democracynow.org. We have a full-time news fellow opening at Democracy Now! You can submit your application by February 5th. Find out more at democracynow.org. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
Help us help you keep Portland weird. Join Contessa de la Luna of the World Famous Confessional for the 6th annual Contessa de la Luna Valentine's Spectacular and Fashion Show. We're giving away a $100 cash prize plus live performances by Contessa de la Luna. Get your weird on and bring a date. Advance tickets available at Brown Paper Tickets. All proceeds benefit your community radio station, KBOO. That's Thursday, February 15th, 7 to 9:45 p.m. Feel the love of your other Contessa de la Lunatics. Contessa de la Luna's Valentine's Spectacular, Thursday, February 15th at the Clinton Street Theater, 7 p.m.
Oregon's child incarceration rate is one of the worst in the country. A new investigative report by Disability Rights Oregon found that kids in custody at NorCor, a jail in the Dalles, receive harsh discipline, including solitary confinement, for infractions such as asking what time it is or for just looking around. These kids are as young as 12 years old. Other states are reducing child incarceration. Why not Oregon? Join us on Prison Pipeline, February 5th at 6:30 p.m.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we take a look at a new law in Oregon that aims to protect janitorial workers from sexual harassment and assault.
We will speak with the Poor People's Campaign here in Portland that is working on reviving Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s work towards economic equity and ending poverty.
And we'll hear about how PayPal has ended its services for organizations in France that are pro-Palestine.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 5th, 2018. I'm Natalie Motti.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. As reported in the Portland Mercury, the family of Quanis Hayes is planning on suing the city for his death almost a year ago. The African-American teenager was shot three times as he was crawling on the ground. The officer, Andrew Hurst, was acquitted of all charges. The family has yet to file a tort claim, the first step in suing the city, but plan on doing so in the near future. They are also planning to address the press this Thursday. Quanis Hayes was shot three times while he was crawling. A toy gun was later found a few feet from his body after the shooting.
A new law has been passed that protects vulnerable people in the janitorial industry from sexual harassment and assault. For more on this, here is KBOO reporter Grace Ann Smith in conjunction with Oregon News Service.
Months before the Me Too movement gained steam, Oregon lawmakers passed legislation to protect women working in the shadows, literally. Now that law is in effect. At the beginning of this year, janitorial contractors started joining a registry that ensures they're in compliance with workplace harassment laws. State Representative Andrea Salinas says sexual harassment and even assault are pervasive in the janitorial industry, and women in this industry often aren't able to speak up because of non-disclosure agreements from settlements or threats from their managers. Even so, Selena says the testimonies the women gave in support of this legislation last year were moving.
This just shows you that an industry where the workers truly do work in the shadows, they work at night, they work alone, sometimes their families don't know the locations of where they're working, their job site, for a few of them to come forward was really powerful.
Selena says there are some technical issues the legislator will clear up this session. She says the law ended up capturing more contractors than lawmakers intended. Many people who work in the janitorial industry are undocumented, making it harder for them to come forward and report harassment or assault. Some receive threats of deportation if they speak up. Selena says a big component of this law is making sure undocumented folks know their rights and that they can go to the law enforcement in these situations. Still, Selena says some contractors have complained that the law is too onerous on their businesses.
We have gotten some pushback, but I think it's really hard to argue against putting in place a system that will help to prevent women and workers from being raped at their work sites.
Felisa Haggins is a political director for Service Employees International Union Local 49, which helped pass this law. She says it's important for women to know where to go and what to do when inappropriate behavior starts, and that this law provides a process where you can report that behavior early and be heard.
My biggest hope is that when we get to the end of this, if one single sexual assault or harassment is prevented, then this bill has really done its work.
In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and the KBOO Evening News, I'm Grace Ann Smith. The Poor People Campaign, a national call for moral revival, is a national movement that is actively unearthing the work and visions of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. In 1967, he said, "I think it is necessary for us to realize that we have moved from the era of civil rights to the era of human rights. When we see that there must be a radical redistribution of economic and political power, then we see that for the last 12 years we have been in a reform movement. That after Selma and the Voting Rights Bill, we moved into a new era which must be an era of revolution. In short, we have moved into an era where we are called upon to raise certain basic questions about the whole of society." Some of the main principles of the Poor People Movement were to uplift those most affected by systemic racism, poverty, the war on economy, and ecological devastation. In the over 40 years that has followed, many of the goals that MLK and his supporters were working to bring into being fell by the wayside. Today, the Poor People's Campaign has delivered letters in roughly 30 states asking members of the House and Senate to address the issues of American poverty that have remained unsolved. The Poor People's Campaign is currently acting on a multi-year plan to see poverty be less of a common experience in the U.S., and they are currently interested in having more volunteers at their orientations. KBOO's Cello Zelos Marchand spoke with the organizer, Robert Quant, about the upcoming actions.
All right, I have Robert Quant, an organizer with the campaign, a national call for more revival here in the studio. Thank you so much, Robert, for jumping in.
It's my pleasure.
So tell us a little bit about how you came to the Poor People's Campaign and why it's important.
Well, fortunately, I actually heard it on KBOO on Monday Morning Talk Radio, and I believe it's important because roughly 75% of Americans earn less than $75,000 a year, and it's very hard to not only maintain a family, but try to make your family better. And I believe that in the Constitution it says, I know in the Constitution it says that one of the founding principles is taking care of the welfare of the people, and we are not doing that as a country.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you also come from a family background where it was hard to make ends meet.
Fortunately, I didn't. I've been rather fortunate to have never wanted for anything, but I know people who have, and I know that it's a hard struggle.
So you want to pay it forward?
Always.
Wonderful. So there's several big actions coming up here, and this is a national movement. So yes. What's happening here in Oregon?
Here in Oregon and across the country, it's coordinated. Currently, I believe it's roughly 30 states coordinating. And so today we announced the campaign, and just letting everybody know, hey, we're back and doing it again. And on Mother's Day this year is going to be the start of 40 days of action at the state capitals.
So there's a letter that has been drafted, and is this being delivered to particular people in each state?
So today it was delivered to the Senate president and the House Speaker in our state. That's Senate President Courtney and House Speaker Kotek, and also delivered to all the other states that have signed on with this movement.
And what's it asking for?
It's really not asking for anything. It's just letting them know that we have, as the people started the Poor People's Campaign up again after 50 years of roughly 50 years of inactivity, saying, letting them know that we will be here and requesting them to start working for the people.
And solving those problems
and working on solving problems and issues.
So it was, I understand that the Poor People's Campaign was inspired or is being carried on from another tradition.
Yes. It was, so Martin Luther King Jr., the doctor reverend, or reverend doctor, started it in 1968, shortly before he was assassinated, and they tried to continue it on, but even in his movement, cannot remember the name of his group, they weren't all behind the Poor People's Campaign. They were still trying to fight for black rights at the time. So it kind of died out, and the main principles of it is the rising up of all poor peoples, especially those of marginalized communities.
Mm. So what can people do to get involved right now? It seems like there's plenty of time to amp up. We got between now and Mother's Day.
Now and Mother's Day, and it's between now and Mother's Day, and it's also just the start of a multi-year campaign. This is not going away.
All right.
That's the goal, is to have this fight go until something gets fixed.
So some things get resolved.
But you can go to thepoorpeoplescampaign.org. There's also a Facebook page, Poor People's Campaign Oregon. I believe I'm not on Facebook, so don't quote me on that one.
You're not the first activist to come in here to go, I'm not on the Facebook.
We have to get the Book of Faces are great.
The Book of Faces, the Isle of Facebook is what I call it.
Fair enough.
It's a lonely island sometimes.
Yes, it can be.
Yeah, you got to get your breaks where you can.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. Okay, so people can go to that website. And I want to circle back to this multi-year campaign thing.
Okay.
And I'm sure a lot of it's not concreted yet. But
no.
What in your mind does that look like, or what have you heard? I know you can't speak at liberty on all things because they're being evolving right now.
It's all being organized, and I'm not very much of an organizer in it yet. We're starting it off. We know that these issues cannot be fixed overnight, and it will take a groundswell of activists and people going out and pushing our legislatures to make this happen. And much like the civil rights movement took roughly a decade and a half to affect any sort of change, this is going to be along the same lines, because you don't get a million people marching in Washington, D.C. in a month or a year.
Mm-hmm.
It takes several years to make that happen. And unfortunately, our government doesn't listen to us unless we have mass loads of people in the streets.
Indeed, indeed. So it sounds like there's lots of different ways people can plug in. You're obviously here just pounding the pavement. That's don't get much more grassroots than that. Mm-hmm. What are some other roles that people can expect to maybe be plugged into when they contact the Poor People's Campaign? What's some big needs that the campaign needs?
Currently, I don't know this. I don't have that information. Like I said, I'm just getting started in it myself. There's several orientations. Once you sign up, you'll get an email that comes out, and they'll key you into the orientation, and I still have yet to take mine. The next one that I'm taking is on the 12th of this month, February.
All right.
The 12th of February at 6 p.m. at Sisters of the Road, and I do not have that address, but at Sisters of the Road, Portland, 6 p.m. on the 12th.
Great.
And I'll be at that, and that's going to be my orientation.
Okay. So closing out, wrapping up a little bit, there's a lot in the Poor People's Campaign that needs to be addressed.
Yes.
And then you're right, history proves it does take time to get these things to get these things solved. So if you had the top three things that you want to see solved, what would those be?
I would like to see no child go hungry in our country, in the richest country in the world. I would like to see rough, equal distribution between the quote-unquote races, between the ethnicities of people. And thirdly, I would say the not redistribution of wealth, but the at least start the conversation of not paying people more than a dollar per second.
I just had to think about that for a minute. Yeah, yeah, okay.
Thank you, Teresa Mitchell, for that one.
Teresa Mitchell is a gem.
That she is.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for coming to KBOO, and thank you so much for sharing what the Poor People's Campaign is all about and what we can expect going forward.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, you bet.
This is Zelos Marchant for KBOO News.
The Dow took a steep plunge today, dropping 1,175 points this morning before regaining some ground. This comes after a year of calm in the market. The Dow's regular session is 1,175 points below anticipated numbers, erasing its gains for 2017. Today marked the Dow's biggest fall, although the lowest drop was recorded in 2011. In total, it's moved 2,100 points in the last two sessions in negative directions, showing a decline of over 8%. The dips have crushed long-term momentum. A big worry on Wall Street is that Federal Review under Chairman Jerome Powell, who was just sworn in Monday, will expedite interest rate hikes and perpetuate a sluggish economy. To put it in a different way, the stock market has lost $1 trillion in value so far this February. Some experts are claiming the dives are a natural part of the economic stock cycle and that the more predictable Dow chart of 2017 has been the anomaly. Investors are keeping an eye on inflation rising in the meantime.
Neonatal Abstinence Syndrome, or NAS, is a term used to describe a set of symptoms that may occur in a newborn whose mother was using opiate drugs during pregnancy. According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, there has been a significant increase in the numbers of infants diagnosed with NAS in the U.S. Traditionally, newborns with NAS taken from their mothers and put into neonatal intensive care units immediately after birth in order to receive care. A new report published in the American Medical Association journal, JAMA Pediatrics, however, finds that better outcomes by the allowing newborns to room with their mothers or other family members after birth. To find out more, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Lynn Paltrow, executive director of the organization National Advocates for Pregnant Women.
Hi, I'm Lynn Paltrow, executive director and founder of National Advocates for Pregnant Women. You can find us online at www.advocatesforpregnantwomen.org. Let me start by saying that we know that healthcare providers receive extremely small amounts, very little education on issues relating to drug dependency and addiction during medical school. In fact, the two subjects they receive the least information on and probably have the greatest need for has to do with drug use, treating addiction and dependency problems, and also certain reproductive health issues like abortion. So where you have an issue of pregnancy and drug use, you have people who have received virtually no training, who get most of their information from exactly the same place everybody listening to this show gets it, from the public discourse, the media, and who have hospital policies that are typically not based on evidence-based research, but on the emotion and misinformation that is absolutely everywhere in the popular media as a result of both the war on abortion and the war on drugs. It's very exciting that this is getting the attention it deserves, but it's actually not that new. Doctors in Vancouver, Canada, and in Scotland, Mary Hepburn in Scotland and Dr. Ron Abrahams in Vancouver, have been providing rooming in care, respectful care for pregnant women who have used drugs or are receiving treatment for opioid addiction, and have published a series of peer-reviewed articles pointing to the value of rooming in. Their work has largely been ignored, and so it's fabulous that there are now researchers in the United States replicating their work and confirming what people should already have known, is that babies need to be with their moms, that the best care we can give is respectful, supportive care that keeps moms and babies together. I want to just explain what neonatal abstinence syndrome is. It has an unfortunate name that sounds like fetal alcohol syndrome, which is a permanent set of harms. Neonatal abstinence syndrome is a set of treatable and transitory symptoms that a baby has at birth that can be alleviated in numerous ways, so that if babies, often portrayed through media hype as suffering, are suffering, it's because they're not getting the right treatment, the right care in the hospital setting they're in, not because they need to suffer. That portrayal of these babies, it then becomes justification for focusing anger and blame on pregnant women, when it really is an issue of simply providing respectful, compassionate, appropriate care that keeps mothers and babies together. While the conclusions of this research shouldn't be a surprise, it does really raise some important questions. Why did so many hospitals respond to the treatable and transitory symptoms of prenatal exposure to opioids by removing babies from their mothers, by putting them in the most expensive place they could be in the hospital, in the neonatal intensive care units, the NICUs, and why were they putting them on high levels of medication? And there are many reasons for that. As I suggested earlier, we live in an environment in which the healthcare providers receive virtually no education on dependency and addiction during medical school, where the information they get is typically from the same place everybody else gets it, the hyped media influenced by the war on drugs. But you also have the fact that if you look to a big pharma solution, Medicaid these babies, somebody's going to profit. If you put babies in NICUs, which can be, you can bill more for that, there's somebody who's going to profit. And it's easier for hospitals to raise money from individual donors to help them pay for the unit they need for these poor babies than for other kinds of health care, including the space needed to allow mothers to stay with their babies in the hospital, which we have known for some time is the best thing you can do for babies.
Any closing thoughts for the listeners? Once again, I've been speaking with Lynn Paltrow, Executive Director, National Advocates for Pregnant Women.
So my closing words are, well, one other issue that would be interesting to follow up on is, as the information and the peer-reviewed research has filtered down to practitioners, healthcare providers, about the value of keeping mothers and babies together, an idea that should not be controversial, we are hearing that many hospitals are not set up to allow mothers and babies to stay in the same room together. When my own kids were born, they were not, there wasn't room, they were twins, but there wasn't enough room for us to stay together. So the idea of rooming in is very simple, but not if your hospital is set up to get people out of the hospital as quickly as possible. If it isn't a way to make more money by either using big pharma or putting babies in NICUs, we have to make very sure that there is a moral imperative that hospitals make space for mothers and babies and for keeping them together.
Again, we're speaking with Lynn Paltrow, Executive Director of National Advocates for Pregnant Women, on the web at advocatesforpregnantwomen.org. Lynn, thank you so much for all your time and for all the work that you do.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
Gerrymandering, the practice of manipulating electoral boundaries by a ruling party in order to favor one party or alienate a group of people, has been in the news a lot lately. In particular, Pennsylvania's Supreme Court had ruled last year that some of their boundaries were indeed unconstitutional and heavily favored the Republican vote. The state was required to redefine those electoral boundaries in a fair manner. The Republican Party, which was favored by these boundaries, immediately asked for a delay in their redistricting. As of today, they have denied a delay on the redistricting because the boundaries were clearly unconstitutional according to the Pennsylvania law, stating that it was, quote, clearly, plainly, and palpably, end quote, violated the state's constitution.
The Public News Service is a member-supported organization that aims to focus on news that may not be covered by popular media. Here's today's roundup.
The Public News Service daily newscast for Monday, February the 5th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Amtrak says a freight operator is to blame for a fatal train crash in South Carolina. Also, on our nationwide rundown, Florida could issue gun permits with incomplete background checks, and a new law dealing with end-of-life decisions up for some tweaking. First, our top story, Amtrak is placing the blame on a freight rail operator for causing a crash on Sunday that killed two people and injured more than 100 others in South Carolina. Reuters reports the collision happened when an Amtrak passenger train was diverted onto a sidetrack and then slammed into a parked unmanned freight train. This was Amtrak's third fatal crash in as many months. Reuters quotes Amtrak's president as saying that the freight operator CSX was responsible for the tracks and the signals, including one that had a lock attached to it and diverted the Amtrak train onto the sidetrack. CSX did not address the comments by Amtrak, but did say it was working with federal investigators. Florida lawmakers considering a proposal now that would let people buy guns without having a completed background check. Tramell Gomes has the details.
Buried near the end of a 114-page bill by Senator Kelly Stargell, a Lakeland Republican, is a provision that would give the Department of Agriculture 90 days after receiving a concealed weapons application to issue a permit, even if the department has not acquired proof of restoration of the person's civil and firearm rights. Taylor Houston with the LGBTQ advocacy group Pride Fund to End Gun Violence calls the change absurd.
It's ironic that they would potentially not be allowing convicted felons who have served their time, you know, restricting their right to vote, but also at the same time giving access to the same convicted felons to carry loaded hidden weapons in public.
The provision in Senate Bill 740 was requested by Florida's Agriculture Commissioner and Republican candidate for governor, Adam Putnam. It's also receiving praise by pro-gun groups as it appears to be advancing to final passage.
A House version of the bill is awaiting a floor vote, where it is also expected to pass. Colorado, one of a number of states making significant gains now in ramping up solar and wind energy, but Eric Tegetthoff has been talking with clean power advocates who warn that momentum and job growth could slow with the Trump administration's plans to cut renewable energy programs.
In a draft budget obtained by the Washington Post, funding for the Department of Energy's renewable programs is cut by 72%. To Amelia Myers with the group Conservation Colorado, that would be taking the nation backwards.
And the future is renewable energy. We've got a ton of wind coming online. Any federal cuts to research and development are going to be very detrimental to our leadership as a state and as a nation.
An analysis by S&P Global projects new wind and solar capacity will top natural gas this year. And Myers notes Colorado's 600-megawatt Rush Creek Wind Farm in Elbert County is the largest wind project under construction in the U.S. The Trump administration has continued to make the case that deeper investments in coal would help the U.S. maintain energy dominance and create jobs.
And as Black History Month begins, Roz Brown reports there's some good news for African Americans in the workforce.
The unemployment rate for African American workers has decreased steadily since 2010, and the retail and restaurant industries can take some of the credit. The Path Forward Coalition is made up of retail and food service companies that recruit and mentor people of color for careers in these fields. Board member Broderick Johnson is an attorney who worked for two U.S. presidents, most recently Barack Obama. But his first job was in retail, and Johnson says it offered valuable lessons.
To do the job well that I was in, to be a very, very good retail clerk, to be responsible, to be responsive, to show up at work every day, to treat customers with respect, to be a team player. And those were skills that made me successful then, but have certainly carried on throughout my career.
For Black History Month, the Path Forward Coalition points out that restaurant and retail businesses are among the most diverse in the country, and that 15% of restaurant managers are people of color. Minority entrepreneurs also are starting more small food and retail businesses. Researchers say the nation's rate of new business creation would have declined over the past three decades if not for these efforts.
And finally, Veronica Carter reports legislation that would tweak a law that deals with the end of life is making its way through the Indiana State House.
In 2013, lawmakers approved the Physician Orders for Scope of Treatment form, also known as the POST. It's different from a Do Not Resuscitate form in that it deals with the type of medical treatment for people with serious and terminal conditions. A grassroots organization called the Indiana Patient Preferences Coalition has asked for clarifications. Susan Hickman is a member of that group and a professor in the Indiana University School of Nursing. She says the current law creates confusion and delays in medical care for many patients.
This just allows them to have those orders recorded on the POST form so that this plan of care can accompany patients across settings and essentially supports the goal of the POST, which is to help ensure continuity of care throughout the healthcare system.
Current law requires a doctor's signature for a POST form to be legal. Under a bill by Representative Cindy Kirchhoffer, an advanced practice nurse or physician assistant could also sign POST forms in collaboration with the patient.
That POST form is a legal document that is binding and enforceable during medical emergencies. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Tomas Kotick, the new instructor of violin at PSU, who has just released two new albums. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be unseasonably warm with a low of around 43 degrees and partly cloudy weather, followed by a high of around 53 degrees and partly cloudy weather. East of the Cascades and Hood River will be getting some of this unseasonable warmth, too. Today in history, in the year 1909, much to the Future Oceans protest, Leo Baekeland created the world's first synthetic plastic, called Bakelite. It's still used in electrical wiring today for its heat-resistant qualities. The quote of the day is from birthday boy William Burroughs, who says, "The junk merchant doesn't sell his product to the consumer. He sells the consumer to his product. He does not improve and simplify his merchandise. He degrades and simplifies the client."
Now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The University of Wyoming has seen a decline in enrollment of Native American students. The new university president set a goal to reverse that by opening a Native American center and hired a Native American program advisor. Yet as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, there's not enough money to fund all the interested students who are applying.
Northern Arapaho Chairman Roy Brown says his tribe is growing quickly, 10,300 members strong. And he says 40% of those members are kids.
About 4,000 of our members are under the age of 18, are going to be looking at opportunities for post-secondary education.
Brown says that prompted the Northern Arapaho Business Council to start brainstorming how they could make sure all those kids have funding to attend college.
One of the ways that we're exploring is starting a dialogue with the Board of Trustees to get a tuition waiver for our tribal members.
A tribal tuition waiver is not a novel idea. Eastern Shoshone member James Trosper is the director of the new Native American Education Research and Cultural Center on campus. He says lots of states already offer tuition waivers or discounts for tribal members.
Fort Lewis is probably the most notable. There are several other colleges in Colorado that also do something similar. CSU has an agreement. Montana is another state.
Michigan, North Dakota, Maine, Idaho. Trosper says these states often offer them as a way to acknowledge broken treaty agreements. Trosper says the same should go for the University of Wyoming.
Most of the universities have agreements with tribes who had previously owned the land where those universities are now built. And this is a good example of an agreement that could be made because this land where the University of Wyoming sits once belonged to the Arapaho.
In fact, Trosper says the entire southeast corner of Wyoming was originally granted to the Northern Arapaho in the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1851.
Honestly, I have mixed emotions about it.
That's UW President Lori Nichols.
I mean, on one level, I would love to do it because I would love tribal members from Wyoming to feel like they have access to a higher education and that finances are not a barrier for them.
But Nichols says the university's budget is tight after a severe downturn in Wyoming's energy industry.
Part of what we've really not done yet is really a financial analysis, is just to take a look at how many tribal members do we have attending the university, and if we gave some kind of a waiver or discount, what would be the financial impact of that, and could we handle it?
The Northern Arapaho Tribe now intends to round up more data for the university's trustees as they consider the proposal. For National Native News, I'm Melody Edwards in Laramie.
The Internal Revenue Service says quite a few tribal families failed to take advantage of a large tax credit. A spokeswoman for the agency says if a family qualifies, it could mean less tax owed or a bigger refund. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
The Earned Income Tax Credit is available for families that earn just under $54,000 a year and meet eligibility requirements. The IRS has identified tribal communities as those that often miss the credit. Karen Connolly with the IRS says there are several reasons money is left on the table.
I think it's mostly because they qualify, but they don't know it. And perhaps they're doing the taxes themselves. They're unable to pay somebody to do it for them, and they're just uneducated about it.
Connolly says working families with qualifying children could end up with another $6,300 from the federal government. She says those preparing taxes can get more information from a qualified tax professional, free community tax help sites, or through the IRS website. I'm Gary Ellen Bolt.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Climate Connections is a daily podcast produced to pull the argument away from climate change towards how we can counter climate change and how it affects our daily lives. Today, we take a look at how climate change could affect our morning coffee.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. That first cup of rich, smooth coffee is a delicious jumpstart to the day, but its taste could change as the climate warms. Aaron Davis at the Kew Royal Botanic Gardens in the UK studies Ethiopian coffee.
Ethiopia is world-renowned for its range of different flavor profiles, and these are really the unique selling point of Ethiopian coffee. That's what makes it special.
But drought and extreme weather pose a threat to those flavors.
If you don't have enough rainfall, then the beans don't develop properly. And that really influences not only the productivity of the bush and each berry, but also the taste.
Davis says farmers could switch to varieties that better withstand the changing climate, but that would limit the range of coffee flavors Ethiopia has to offer and eliminate the farmer's competitive edge. Another option is to change farming practices.
They can mulch the soil, they can improve the shade coverage, and if possible, they can irrigate. Those are all things that do have an impact.
But changes cost money.
We should be paying more for our coffee, and that would help secure its future if that money went back to the people that actually produce the coffee.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Current Cast is a podcast focusing on one of our most important resources, water. Today, they are taking a look at how you can explore the preserved shipwreck remains in Lake Huron.
Archaeological history preserved in the Great Lakes on this Current Cast. The cold freshwater of Lake Huron makes it ideal for preserving the historic shipwrecks that are part of the Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary. Superintendent Jeff Gray says that although the monuments and sites might be underwater, there's plenty to see.
we really work hard to encourage people to get out in the sanctuary and experience some of these magnificently preserved shipwrecks. And you can do that through diving, kayaking, snorkeling, and we even have a glass-bottom boat now that takes people out and they can go see a shipwreck without getting wet.
There are over 24 documented shipwrecks that can be explored, making Thunder Bay perfect for anyone wanting to experience this national treasure. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Esmond Bradley Martin, an American investigator into the illegal trade of ivory in rhino horn markets, was found stabbed to death in his home in Nairobi. Bradley Martin was one of the world's leading investigators responsible for helping to curtail a dangerous black market that severely impacted the health of Africa's elephant and rhino populations. Nicholas Kamwende, head of criminal investigations in Nairobi, told the Associated Press that a family member had dropped by to visit Bradley Martin after he didn't respond to phone calls and then discovered his body on a bed with stab wounds to the neck. Bradley Martin's large and risky work as a conservationist and investigator elevated him to being a worldwide authority on rhino and elephant poaching. Dan Stiles, his colleague for many years, told NPR earlier today that Esmond revolutionized the way wildlife investigations were carried out. He was one of the first people to gather quantitative data, posing as a buyer. There were times that both of us were in rather precarious situations. A report by Bradley Martin published last year by Save the Elephants found that the legal trade of ivory in China was waning in anticipation of the country's ban, which took effect January 1st. Reuters reports that his research was key to China deciding to enact the ban on rhino horns, which was legal until 1993.
President Abdullah Yameen of the Maldives, an island nation in the southwest part of Sri Lanka and India, declared a 15-day state of emergency today. Security forces have begun storming the Maldivian Supreme Court through deep political divides in the island nation. Police have arrested former President Mamoun Abdul Gayoom today on charges of bribery and treason. The state of emergency comes after a stark ruling by the Supreme Court February 1st, which ordered the release of imprisoned opposition leaders. Yameen refused to comply with this order and went a step further by saying that the court was attempting to oust him. Legal Affairs Minister Azima Shakur read the emergency decree on state television, directly instructing security forces to make arrests in hopes of curtailing the powers of the judiciary. The United Nations, the European Union, and many other foreign governments, including India, the U.S., and the U.K., have been urging Yameen to comply with the Supreme Court's order.
The popular online payment service PayPal has recently shut down the French BDS account as well as an AFPS account. BDS, or Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, is a nonviolent organization that aims to take power away from Israel in the form of economic sanctions in protest of their occupation of Palestine. The AFPS, or the France-Palestine Solidarity Association, stated that the members of France-Palestine Solidarity Association are attached to the right of peoples to self-determination and to the defense of the individual. Their purpose is to develop solidarity with the Palestinian people and to support them, particularly in their fight for the fulfillment of their national rights. This comes on the heels of Israel releasing a list of what they call terrorist organizations and putting pressure on Silicon Valley to pool any Palestinian support. A member of the French government is quoted as saying that he can't comment specifically on PayPal or the organization, but singling out a country for boycotting is against the French anti-hate laws, which strictly prohibit discrimination based on national origin. However, as reported in the International Middle East Media Center, PayPal has already been under fire for refusing services to anyone living within Palestine. The AFPS said that they received a very succinct email that their services were being canceled due to the nature of their service. However, the AFPS has stated that their services have been transparent and unchanging for the past 2 years.
You're You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Grace Ann Smith, Zealous Ellis Marchant, and Doug McVeigh. The producer is Grace Ann Smith. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zealous Ellis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Natalie Motti.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up this morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk radio show. Call in and talk radio covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener comments. At 9, on Alternative Radio, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, Richard Wolff says the new GOP tax plan is simply warmed over trickle-down economics. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Stage and Studio, D-May features Chitra, The Girl Prince, co-directed by Sarah Jane Hardy and Anita Menon, now playing at the Northwest Children's Theater and School. And at 11:30, Art Focus features interviews with artists, curators, and critics. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Tomas Kotik is the new professor of violin studies at Portland State University, and he's recently released two rich albums of music. One is dedicated to the work of Argentinian composer Astor Piazzolla, and the other to Mozart.
Gorgeous, gorgeous music. It's just beautiful, but I'm sure you get that all the time.
Well, I don't know. It's so much effort and years put into each of these projects. So you never know how people will feel about each release every time. And there have been several releases lately. The Mozart release of his 16 sonatas, Astor Piazzolla disc, and one disc that I recorded a couple of more than a couple of years ago with a string quartet I was a part of when I used to live in Miami.
Mm. Who is Astor Piazzolla, for those who don't know? I certainly am new to this artist.
He's my countryman, or better said, I am his countryman. He was a composer of what's called now as Tango Nuevo, New Tango. And if we think of the old traditional tango that many people here might have heard here or there, Astor Piazzolla took the tango and he made sort of a revolution. He mixed it with influences of jazz, rock, classical music, and he made a music that is very fresh even today, even if he died 25 years ago. He was born in Argentina, but he spent many years in New York when he was growing up, and returned to Argentina, then lived in many countries. He studied also in France, and through that multiculturalism that he lived, he got to write this. So Astor Piazzolla lived in so many different countries. He, growing up, he experienced the old traditional tango and maybe many different kinds of music, and that made him synthesize his own musical style, which is that new tango.
It's wonderful. What made you decide to pair Mozart with somebody so remarkably different like Astor Piazzolla?
Well, through the last many years, there have been like these two big legs to the work I have been doing in the recording studio. I started recording many years ago doing the complete works of Franz Schubert, who's an early Romantic composer, and the Mozart recording, this big project of recording 16 sonatas, which is 4 hours and a half of music, is pretty a big monster to do. That came after finishing the Schubert project, that those recordings had luckily a very nice reception by the press, and that encouraged us to follow up with that dream of recording Mozart sonatas. And at the same time, parallel to all that work with these classical and early Romantic pieces of Schubert, I wanted to play this completely different music, even almost opposite, because the music of Piazzolla has a little bit of the aggression of Buenos Aires, the megapolis of Buenos Aires, and a little bit of the filthiness, if you want, of the beginnings of tango. Tango is a music that originated in the bordel. So we have completely different characters, and I have fun playing both, and these two releases happened to coincide pretty much in a few months.
How many years have you been practicing the art of violin playing?
Well, 32 years. I have been playing for about 32 years now. I don't want to imagine how many hours, but
countless hours, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And why do you love it? What made you decide violin was the way that you wanted to express music?
I asked my parents to get me a violin when I was 5 years old. No one in my family was a musician. They are, everyone pretty much is from the sciences, but I felt in love with the sound of the violin when I heard one old vinyl record. The sound touched me so much that I asked them, and it took me asking for 3 years until I got them to buy me a violin. And since then, you know, I thought I would do a traditional career until I was 18, but eventually I realized that this is what I really want to spend my life doing. And I think there's so many layers to music, because it affects each one of us in so many levels, physical, intellectual, but you know, if I have to reduce it to one thing that keeps me attracted to do this every day for so many hours, and to be teaching now at the university, at Portland State University, and sharing what I love with a new generation of students, is the love to sound. That's the most immediate reaction that keeps me going.
So it sounds like, is that what you hope others will also love about the violin?
I certainly try
to inspire my students. And when I play concerts, I certainly hope that I'm able to reach people through sound and telling this, you know, this music that is between 250 years old, and Piazzolla is more recent, 30 years old, still trying to make this music come to life, and it tells so much about being human, I guess, because it still affects us after so many years. So
That's beautiful. Do you also compose? I know a large part of classical music is understanding repertoire and performing that and giving that new life, but I was curious to know if you write.
No, I would love to, but it seems like life is too short. I would need another life. You know, at the time of Mozart, every performer pretty much would compose and improvise. I guess we got farther in many aspects, but musicians nowadays have stopped a little bit, probably for worse, on like music performers have stopped composing and improvising, and I think that's great to do. For myself, I feel like, you know, with all these projects that I have been doing and all the projects that I have ahead, I'm not sure life's long enough.
There's a lot. And certainly today there's a lot of repertoire that I could imagine it being challenging doing both writing and executing a piece to perfection. So I know we've talked a lot about your you know, how you're bringing works to life and about your students and why you chose to bring Mozart and Piazzolla together. What's your personal approach to art? You know, there's a lot of practicing involved. What inspires you to keep getting up every day and dedicating your life to the violin?
Well, in a way, what we do, it has a little bit a part of like sports. You know, if you don't do it for 2 months, you feel like you're handicapped. So we are a little bit slaves of our bodies in terms of keeping in shape, because it's such a detailed work. And after all that physical or technical work, it comes, of course, you know, why we play music and how do we understand and what we understand about the composers. I'm very interested in trying to know as much as possible about how people played music in Mozart's time. And that doesn't mean that I do everything like they did. First of all, because we know so little. There's no recordings of those times. There's only some writings, and we don't even know if those writings affect the music of Mozart directly. But finding out more about the affects, about what music was about in that time, which is somehow different about what it is today, and understanding how the instruments were built and how what strings and what kind of bows people using those times inspires me to reinterpret and to understand this music. And the same about Piazzolla. We don't know precisely what went on his head when he composed a piece, or even if we know what the context of his life was, it's not for sure that on that particular day something else happens that we don't know, and the piece has a completely different meaning than what we're thinking. But still, knowing more about the composers and about performance praxis is something that inspires me to understand and to try to interpret the music, not only as how what do I feel about this piece, but what is the composer saying and what's the style of the composer. And regarding arts, I'm interested in very different sorts of arts. I always, you know, as a musician, a lot of times you travel a lot, sometimes a little bit more than you want. And when you're traveling, it's super busy. But I always try to go to museums, and all of that is enriching, I guess, for myself as a person. And I would say that eventually it comes through, but not in a way that could describe it in words.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful. So let's talk about your CDs. Is it released already? Is it a future release date?
The Piazzolla release was in October, last October.
Okay.
And the Mozart release was just 3 days ago or something like that, February 2nd. There's one more release of a group I used to play with, which is teach at Curtis, and now he's living and teaching in LA, and we had the privilege of world premiering that. We were the first to perform and record many of these pieces, and these are three quartets that were also released on Naxos, like the Piazzolla album.
Okay. Could you say that artist's name again? Because it's the artist that you're playing with in LA.
Richard Daniel Poor.
All right. And so do you have any future performances coming up?
Yes, I have a few. At the beginning of March, I will be playing at Portland State University, where I teach. If you want, I can tell you the date.
Please do.
Will you? Yeah, okay, just 1 second. So I'm playing on March 8th at 12, at noon at Portland State University, Lincoln Hall. That's room 75. It's a free admission. There's also a concert at Old Classical Portland. I'm not sure if that's the enemy. So that concert is at Old Classical Portland on March 1st at 3 p.m. And that I believe it's also free admission, but requires reservation. And then I have a few other concerts, one at Friends of Chamber Music, Portland on March 11th at 3 p.m. And then I will be playing at some high schools. I often try to be involved in the community, trying to inspire kids at schools and also in retirement homes. So that's